Today in Studio 360, Willem Dafoe. You'd think the actor who stars in Lars von Trier movies or The English Patient wouldn't be into superhero blockbusters, but he loves a good popcorn movie.
I'm not as attracted to conventional acting scenes with psychology and great writing. I like the event.
And these days, anyone can become part of a movie event. Years before Hollywood got The Hunger Games into theaters, fans were dramatizing their own scenes from the book and posting them on YouTube.
Everyone was just so into it. How often do you get to kill people on a Saturday afternoon?
Plus, I'll talk about war with the great fiction writer George Saunders. That's all ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today I'll talk with the actor Willem Dafoe. Some of his movies may freak you out a little, and he's okay with that.
That's what art does. It keeps us away from the lies. It wakes us up. It's a slap in the face.
We'll also meet one of the hottest up-and-comers at this year's South by Southwest Music Festival, the Australian pop star Kimbra. Now I can spend a minute. Now I can't steal the time. I've lost all my friends like mine. But first, we need to talk about war. In the decade, more than a decade, that we've been fighting in Afghanistan, this month has been among the very worst. First, there was the military squad's burning of the Qurans. Then, a sergeant with three tours in Iraq behind him apparently went on a shooting spree, killing 16 civilians, nine of them children. People have been trying to make sense of that. Looking for marital or financial problems, brain injuries, trying to understand what made this man snap. George Saunders is a novelist and essayist who's written movingly about today's wars and veterans, and I wanted to talk with him about this tragedy. George, welcome back to Studio 360.
Nice to be here, Kurt.
These kinds of stories of the you know, ordinary soldier who suddenly goes off the deep end in an entirely unexpected way. I am sure such things happened in the 1950s, but it seems as though it's a trope that has existed only since Vietnam.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm not sure because the story that I wrote for The New Yorker was called Home. And that story came out of a reading that I did of Heracles.
The Euripides play.
Yeah, Heracles goes to the underworld, you know, presumably not a lot of fun, and comes home to find that a king is threatening his family. So Heracles, being a righteous hero, is going to kill the king. And as he's about to do it, and the reader is feeling very happy about this, the figure of madness comes and perches on Heracles' house. You know, it's not stated, but it's sort of felt that madness came along with him from the underworld. So when he goes to kill the king, he does that, but he also kills his own wife and children. So I was really just trying to riff on that.
That story that you published in the New Yorker Home, for listeners who haven't read the story yet, can you sort of give a thumbnail of what this, who this guy is and what he's going through?
Sure. He's a soldier of a kind of, you know, murky war, maybe in the future, even in the Middle East. And he comes home and it's really his first day home and he's trying to adjust. And we get the feeling that he might have done something pretty terrible back there, but has been acquitted of it. And so it's kind of just him trying to adjust to life in America, but you can sort of feel the tension rising. Things aren't going well. His wife is remarried. His family is kind of disconnected. And then hilarity ensues.
And everybody routinely says to him, and he never reacts to, thank you for your service.
Right, which I think has become kind of a contemporary bromide. I mean, nobody wants to do, you know, what we did, or what supposedly someone did after Vietnam, and spit on the vet. So everybody does kind of a similar thing, which is to just banally say, thank you for your service.
This routine genuflection, yes.
Yeah, I'm sure, and I've talked to vets who say that's so irritating. You know, I mean, the sentiment is good, but it's sort of it become a bit of a reflex at this point.
This great story of yours, home, has this sense of dread. Oh my God, what's going to? Oh, he's about to. What's going to happen? That he's going to snap at any minute. And in the end, spoiler alert, for those who haven't yet read it, he doesn't quite. Although it's not clear that he won't an hour from now or a week from now. I mean, as you were making the choice of how to finish that story, what went through your mind?
Well, you know, as you know, part of that, the fiction writing process is that you, and this is almost clear of theme or intent, you don't want to do the most obvious thing. You know, Heracles freaks out and kills everybody, and then that's the end. And in this one, I thought, well, okay, so we have that already. What else can happen? And if so, by what mechanism? So in this story, one of the things that came just out of the blue, as it sometimes will, is that for him, there was a lifeline, which was, this is a corny way of saying it, but community. You know, his family, who up to this point in the story has been sort of strange and distant and disconnected and blind to him, suddenly they kind of rally around.
So you say the germ of that story was from Euripides, but were there more proximate inspirations that made you write that?
I was on an airplane at one point, and I sat next to a kid who had been in Iraq two tours and was going back for a third, and really nervous, really wanting to talk, but at the same time seemed like he didn't quite have the self-permission and or the vocabulary to do it. So it was the first time I'd sort of seen this pent-up energy, and this was, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years ago. So I think that was in my mind a bit, the idea that, you know, if we have an experience and don't have a vocabulary or an ability to express it, then that just, you know, makes the energy build up more and more. And in the story, the guy is sort of inarticulate, not completely, but isn't able to say or think the things that he needs to kind of clean himself out. And so it manifests in action, I guess.
You and I are not psychologists, but it seems to me over the last few decades, especially, psychology seems to have decided that pretty much all of us have the capacity to do horrific things. People who commit massacres live with something called forward panic, where their fear turns into rage. Does that make sense to you as a person who professionally imagines other minds?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fiction is interesting, as you know, because you know the only resource you have is empathy or some kind of extrapolation from your own experience. So when I was writing about this guy, I kept thinking, well, I certainly would never commit an excess, except there was that one time I lost my temper, or there's that one time I was doing something I felt was morally suspect, but kept doing it because I didn't quite have the courage to back out of it. Or so I think fiction is sort of an enactment of that process of walking a mile in someone else's shoes, which in this circumstance means the unspeakable isn't, you know, the unimaginable isn't.
George Saunders, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Kurt. Always a pleasure.
The writer George Saunders. His short story called Home, about a combat veteran, appeared in The New Yorker. You can find it at studio360.org. It may not be coincidence that the biggest deal in pop culture right now isn't wizards or vampires. It's about a brutal contest in which young people, ordinary humans, kill each other for entertainment. The Hunger Games movie is out this weekend. It's based on Suzanne Collins' novels about a teenage girl living in a totalitarian future America called Pan Am.
And so it was decreed that each year, the 12 districts of Pan Am shall offer up in tribute one young man and woman between the ages of 12 and 18 to be trained in the art of survival and to be prepared to fight to the death.
Children fighting to the death on national TV. It's Lord of the Flies meets Survivor. So the official movie is just out, but YouTube has been full of Hunger Games, homemade fan versions for years. Studio 360's Michelle Siegel talked to some of those young filmmakers.
2 years ago, when Hannah Snyder was in eighth grade, she and her friend Claire became so obsessed with the Hunger Games, they thought,
we should make this into a movie. It'd be so cool. So we wrote a script for the entire book, and we looked at it, and we were like, oh, wait a minute. This is not practical.
They dropped the idea, but when Hannah got to high school, she took a filmmaking class.
That's when I realized, like, I really loved film, and I went back to Claire, and I said, Claire, like, we should actually, like, try and make the Hunger Games.
Hannah managed to get a TV station in Pittsburgh to lend her a camera. Then she and Claire went scouting for the best filming location.
We drove around South Park, which is this humongous park full of fields, and we sat there, we made a list of the fields we liked the most, and we would go there and we'd be like, no, the grass is too cut here, and we would like trying to figure out what looked the most like the Hunger Games. So we decided to do one scene from the book, and that was the feast scene.
In that scene, a competitor from District 2 chases Katniss, the heroine, tackles her, then holds a knife to her face.
Forget it, District 12. We're gonna kill you, just like we killed your pathetic little ally. What was her name?
The one who hopped around in the trees.
Rue.
Well, first Rue,
then you, and then I think we'll let nature take care of lover boy.
How's that sound?
Do you think Suzanne Collins has seen your video on YouTube?
I've thought about that, and it kind of, like, shakes me up inside to think that she has.
Suzanne Collins certainly hasn't watched all of the videos on YouTube, because right now there are hundreds of faithful Hunger Games scenes posted there.
Forget it, District 12. We're gonna kill you.
We're gonna kill you, just like we did your pathetic little ally. What was her name? The one that hopped around in the trees.
The one who jumped around from tree to tree. Rue? First Rue, then you.
But the video by Hannah and her team, they call themselves Books to Film, has 1.1 million hits and counting.
And like a million people is a lot of people, you know, and it's hard to imagine who has seen it.
A college student named Kim Shelby took a totally different approach with her video. It's beautifully filmed and has almost no dialogue. In 2 minutes, she unpacks the book's violence, tension, even romance, in a way I haven't seen in any other video, including the official trailer from Lionsgate.
Suzanne Collins made it violent. Kids killing kids. She went all the way with it, and that made it so much more dangerous and so much more real.
No, Katniss! Katniss! No!
Kim was in her senior year studying graphic design at Southern Utah University. A movie poster would have been enough to meet her degree requirement, but Kim spent 8 months producing an actual trailer for a movie that didn't exist. The mountain desert landscape of southern Utah is dazzling. There's this gorgeous glow with the yellow wildflowers, and golden light bounces off the actors' faces.
With a zero budget, I knew that we couldn't go far. I didn't want to ask kids to drive an hour and a half, and so every single location was 5 minutes from campus.
The real dramatic set piece of the video is a choreographed fight scene with 24 kids.
That is the very beginning of the games, and that's the bloodbath, where the bell rings and everybody runs. There was tons of fake blood. There was real fighting going on. All of the weapons were brought by the boys, who had them under their beds for whatever reason that they have weapons. Everyone was just so into it. How often do you get to kill people on a Saturday afternoon?
To find just the right actor to play PETA, Katniss's love interest, Kim went to her classmates.
And so I walked in and I just stood there and said, I need a really good-looking blonde guy. And I knew how shallow that sounded, but all of the girls in the class immediately got on Facebook. And within 2 days, I had a phone number for Jeff, this super handsome guy, and it was probably the most nerve-wracking phone call I ever made for the project.
He really is quite attractive.
For being a 21-year-old with $300, $200 of the dollars paid for food, and then $20 for Katniss's boots, and then you do the math for the rest of what was left. And for what it came out to be, I'm so proud of what it was.
You can see that it really sparked their own creativity, that these teens making these videos, it isn't just about honoring the books, but it also is an expression of their own creativity.
David Levithan is the editorial director of Scholastic, which publishes Suzanne Collins' Hunger Games trilogy.
That's pretty much one of the highest compliments an author can get, is to know that their book has inspired somebody else to go out and create something. It's the same way, I'm sure, for a singer seeing 10,000 people cover their song on YouTube. I mean, it's fun to see that people are so in love with it. And I think I would say that it's also cool that it has happened before the movie came out, because once the movie comes out, there is going to be sort of an official screen version of what this world looks like and what this story looks like.
And what's kind of great and amazing is that a lot of talented young filmmakers got to get their visions out in the world first. For Studio 360, I'm Michelle Siegel.
You can see some of those fan versions of The Hunger Games at studio360.org. The Hollywood film, as you undoubtedly know, is out this weekend. Coming up, the actor Willem Dafoe is a master of edgy roles. He started young.
And my parents call and say, "You were making porno films at school. What's going on?"
That's ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. South by Southwest ended last week. The original cool alternative entertainment festival in Austin has grown into the industry's behemoth. Something like 2,000 singer-songwriters, bands, rappers, and DJs are all competing for attention. So if you really want to make an impression there, you've got to go all out.
We've played a number of shows. I think it's a total of 9 shows within the space of about, 4 days. Now and then I think of all the times you screwed me over. But it made believing it was always something that I'd done.
That's 21-year-old Kimber Johnson, who came to the festival from Melbourne, Australia. If you turned on the radio or left the house any time last year, you probably heard her on this song, the huge hit, Somebody That I Used to Know. But South by Southwest was her American debut as a solo artist.
American audiences are so sort of expressive. I think they're just a little louder and a little, more, charismatic to perform to. It's fun.
You shout way more than Australia. It's way funner.
So I write all my own music and lyrics. I guess I've been getting into the production world a little bit as well, and I really would love to get to the point where I can fully produce my own records. So I work on the computer with different software. I spend a lot of time listening to idols of mine in the production world, like Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails or Cornelius, a Japanese producer. I also love more recent artists like St. Vincent and Janelle Monáe. I think they're really incredible kind of female voices for today.
Boom, 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 ba. I wanna settle down.
Boom, boom, ba.
I wanna settle down.
Boom, boom, ba.
Won't you settle down
boom,
with
boom, ba.
Me? Settle down.
Boom, boom, ba.
We can settle at a table.
Boom, boom, ba.
I loved Broadway and musical theater when I was a kid. I was in all the shows, and I just love the theater of it all and the color and the musicality of it all. If you dissect Andrew Lloyd Webber, if you dissect, all of those composers, there's an incredible complexity in the songwriting, and that's really stuck with me. I really respond to drum beats. You have a great groove that is the backbone to a wonderful song, and from there, melodies and lyrics jump off the beat a lot easier. But then again, you know, I play guitar, and sometimes I'll sit down and a song will come completely in the most organic way possible. That's the beautiful mystery of songwriting, is that there is no clear-cut process.
And I've got a lot to lose, you've got a lot to prove, I've got a lot to risk, you know I can't afford to miss. So we go on and on forever just typing, thinking of what could have been and might be. I know you say sorry, you take back the fall, running round in limbo, running round it all.
You can see a video of Kimbra performing at South by Southwest at Studio360.org. Her album Vows comes out here in May. Studio 360's Josh Rogerson produced our story. So, just how good is Willem Dafoe? Well, let's think. What other actor has played both a drug dealer and an FBI agent, a vampire and a vampire killer, Jesus Christ, and the lead in a film called Antichrist, and not one, but two different green monsters? The Green Goblin from Spider-Man.
You know how much I sacrificed!
And now a 9-foot Martian in the new movie John Carter.
Jeddak.
Jeddak.
Jeddak. Tars Tarkas.
Willem Dafoe isn't just versatile. He is still, after 80 movies, very much in demand. In addition to John Carter, this month he's hunting the last Tasmanian tiger in The Hunter and dealing with an apocalypse in 444, The Last Day on Earth. In other words, most of the movies that I've seen in the last month star Willem Dafoe, who is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks.
So, as I mentioned, you're in three new movies this spring, but I want to first talk about The Hunter, which takes place in Tasmania, the Australian island. You play this mysterious hunter who's hired by a mysterious biotech company to find the last Tasmanian tiger. Who is this guy? Did you or the director have a clear backstory in mind?
Not really, and I don't think we needed one. The story is based on a novel by Julia Lee of the same title, and his identity is very caught up in his work, so I had to know how to do those things. I had to be very clear about certain hunting things, certain trapping things.
No, you look very fluent in all of your hunting.
I had to be.
But in order, you don't have to trick yourself into inventing a life to be this.
I rarely do. I mean, some people do. On occasion, I have that, but my triggers for pretending are very different. You have things in the script like he sets a trap. Now, we're there. What is that for? What does that scene mean? What is accomplished? What do we want to have happen? What do we want to suggest? So you have to have a certain knowledge. Also, you look at the train. You got to find the right place to set the trap. I'm there by myself. I don't have all these advisors with me. So by that time, I had to know animal runs and a logic to where I put the trap and that sort of thing.
Really? So once you were out there shooting, there wasn't like a technical advisor next door?
Not all the time.
As I watched you stalk the wilderness with a gun, I was, of course, reminded of Platoon, in which you were in 1986, and for which you got an Oscar. Oscar nomination.
Slight difference.
Well, it's an honor just to be nominated. Isn't that the cliche?
That's it.
you famously, for that film, 25 years ago, endured months of physical military training in the jungle. I want to play a clip of you as Sergeant Elias. Talking with your new recruit, Charlie Sheen, after a big confrontation with the other sergeant.
Barnes has got it in for you, doesn't he?
Barnes believes in what he's doing.
And you? You believe?
I'm 65, yeah. No. What happened today is just the beginning. we're gonna lose this war.
Come on. You really think so? Us?
We've been kicking other people's asses for so long, I figure it's time we got ours kicked.
Never realized I sound so much like John Wayne.
There you go. That was obviously an intense shoot, sort of, you know, Apocalypse Now too, a little bit, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, different jungle. I like those intense locations. I think I'm attracted to those kinds of movies, not just for the fact that they're exotic. Is the world drops away and it really invites you to be transformed.
Is that what you meant? You once were quoted as saying what I always found a very interesting thing, which is the making of a movie is always better than the movie?
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Just personally, because it sounds maybe strange, but a huge part is the kind of life adventure.
And yet you're probably not going to die. So it's safe in that sense. Yeah.
Exactly. It's a lab. It's a safe lab.
It's sort of a Werner Herzogian approach to movies, right? You worked with him.
I have. And I've always admired that approach, actually.
You had, before that role in Platoon, you had played a lot of bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
Playing Sergeant Elias in that big movie, was that an important career thing?
It was a small movie that became a big movie.
Right.
Yeah, I think it was. In those days, I was working at the Wooster Group, a theater in New York. I worked there for, almost, I don't know, a little over 25 years. And that was my day job. Movies were the sideline. it's instructive to remember that. But I was always conscious that in the movies, I was always worried about being typecast early in my career, only because I was worried about opportunities.
You have, however, worked with kind of, as I was going through the list, an amazing pantheon of movie directors. Mm-hmm. Scorsese, Spike Lee, Oliver Stone, Lars von Trier, David Lynch, mm-hmm. Werner Herzog, Alan Parker, Sam Raimi, Catherine mm-hmm. Bigelow. Yeah. I could go on.
Yeah.
Is there one of them, if you had to choose, that I'd really like to work with him or her again?
Almost all of them I'd work with again, because now I have some sort of trust or rapport with them. And, you know, I'm totally attracted to directors with a strong vision. If you've got someone that's trying to articulate something and it's not always clear, and you just make yourself available and the story works on you, the problems work on you, it becomes a relationship that's always a little enlightening, and that becomes the inner life of the character.
And so you become their tool, which seems to me, it either you're going to end up loving that person because it's such a vulnerable thing, or hating them.
It's true. I mean, they can improve on what you do, you know, because it remains, no matter what kind of film it is, it's an editor's and the director's medium. I remember when David Lynch proposed this Bobby Peru character to me. In the script, it says he has rotten teeth. Well,
in Wild at Heart.
Yeah, and the first thing David did, I just assumed they were going to, you know, make my teeth funky with makeup. First thing he said is, we got to get you to an orthodontist, get those teeth made. And I thought, cool, I limited myself. It never occurred to me that that's what I needed. And once I got those teeth, believe it or not, that was a case of the costume or the makeup.
I can totally imagine.
Doing the role, because you put those things in, your mouth is, you know, in this lascivious kind of drop, slack-jawed attitude all the time, and it changes everything.
Yeah. Oh.
Hey, pretty woman. Sailor here?
Oh, he's changing the oil in our car.
Man, I gotta take a piss, Ben. Can I use your head?
Yeah, I guess.
I don't mean your head. I'm not gonna piss on your head, your hair and all. Just gonna piss in the toilet. Y'all take a listen. You hear a deep sound coming down from Bobby Peru.
Another one of your movies out right now is John Carter, which is this science fiction adaptation of the Edgar Rice Burroughs books directed by Andrew Stanton, in which you play a 9-foot-tall green Martian warrior.
Yes, warrior king.
How'd you get that part?
I heard Andrew was making this movie. I knew it was a dream of his ever since childhood. I had worked with him on Finding Nemo, and even though I was just voicing a character, we shot the whole movie with the characters. I wore 3-foot stilts. We played out the scenes. So it's like they're basically animating to my gestures and the rhythm of the scene.
Your first role in Hollywood, I believe, was on Heaven's Gate as an extra, I guess?
Or a glorified extra.
Yeah. Glorified extra, which, of course, is the synonym for giant Hollywood flop now. John Carter may make its money back, but it cost $250 million, and people are talking about
Puritans,
maybe
cowards.
Really? You're still fully behind.
I hope. I think it's a good movie, and I think it's really kind of kinky how this became a business story. There's a science of tracking things, and they just don't let things breathe. And once they smell blood or something, they just go for it, and they tighten the formula. They don't let anything happen. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You see it in the positive with something like Hunger Games, you know?
Right.
We know how that's going to do.
You got into acting as a kid, as a teenager, growing up in Wisconsin in Harry Houdini's hometown.
Yeah.
Was that as Morning in America perfect 50s, 60s life as one imagines?
You know, I thought so as I was living it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was perfectly happy, but I look back and we had a very unusual upbringing because both my families work. I came from a big family and it was very independent living. My house was a beautiful chaos. And I remember huge periods where I lived at a friend's house and I don't think anybody even knew.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it true you were kicked out of high school for making a dirty movie?
It's true. It's true.
Just like a little Super 8 thing?
Or? Well, you know, I had a media class and magazine
How
shows.
How 70s?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was 72, I guess. Yeah. And we would make these magazine shows, and I decided to interview 3 people at our school that were outsiders. You can see a theme here, maybe. One called himself a Satanist. One called himself a nudist, and one called himself a drug dealer.
In Appleton, Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And I interviewed them, and I left to go have lunch, and the stuff was still on the editing table. Some curious, nosy teacher came in. Before it was finished, looked at the footage, stuff that I was never going to use, freaked, locked the door, and my parents call and say, "You were making porno films at school. What's going on?" Not really.
Sounds like the first act of a Wes Anderson comedy. You should make a movie out of it.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It was very Wes Anderson.
Not that you meant so much to be transgressive then, but your career has had its, like, pushing the edge moments.
I think it's important. I think it's important. You know, as you get older, that becomes less important. But I think it's important because it's all about shaking down how we think, you know, looking behind the surface of things, seeing what's really going on, you know, exposing the lies. Because, you know, I think we're all, that's what art does. It keeps us away from the lies. It wakes us up. It's a slap in the face.
Well said. Your last moment of slapping people in the face and getting a big public sort of controversy going was, I guess,
a slap of face with a kiss.
Yes. Well, and more. In Antichrist, the Lars von Trier movie that sort of scandalized people. Mm-hmm. You play this psychiatrist who is helping your wife, played by Charlotte Gainsbourg, through the horror of your son's death. I want to play a clip.
Okay.
It's like role playing. My role is all the thoughts that provoke your fear. Yours is rational thinking. I'm nature. All the things that you call nature.
Okay, Mr. Nature. What do you want?
To hurt you as much as I can.
By frightening me?
By killing you.
It foreshadows that scene a lot of the actual violence to come, which is at times excruciating to watch. Mm-hmm. What's it like to act those scenes of violence out?
You know, one of the big things about Lars is he prohibits rehearsal. But in some of the violence, you know, you have props, you have practical matters to deal with, so you have multiple takes. So that kind of breaks his rule. You know, I'm running around for a lot of the movie with a millstone driven through my leg. I mean,
you're not imagining as much, I guess, the final effect and look of those scenes on screen.
No, I never think of that.
Really?
I think about being present and receiving the story. Sometimes you have to push. Like this movie, I had to drive because she's inhabiting this very destroyed state. Some other times, you don't do it at all. I think back to Last Temptation. That is such a reactive character. I loved it because I could just be present and the story would tell you where to go.
That's the Martin Scorsese movie, yes, in which you play Jesus Christ, our Savior.
Yes.
I ran here to Nazareth, where I grew up, to bring you the news. The world of God is here now.
You work miracles. Make a miracle for us. Make us believe in you. Otherwise, go away.
The Messiah doesn't need miracles. He is the miracle. Now he's here. Are you ready for me?
Not long ago, the New York Times Fashion Magazine did an entire piece about this face of yours that I'm looking at.
Face for radio?
Obviously not. It's a face for motion pictures. But it said it looked like, and I get this, that it was rendered by a cubist. And then I just want to read a quote from this piece. His face is all facets. His cheekbones jut over great suffering hollows. His lips are full. His mouth so wide that his smile creates horizontal lines on his cheeks that could pass for cat's whiskers. And now they're doing it.
Yeah.
did you think of your face as remarkable when you were growing up?
No.
No? You were just another kid in Wisconsin?
Pretty much. You know, moon-faced. I didn't have these hollows. I think a lot of years of heavy theater makeup and a lot of stressed characters and working hard has had its toll. I mean, I knew I didn't look like everyone else, but I looked like my family.
Right.
And the other interesting thing is I've always found when I go places, people can project different things onto you. They say, oh, you must be Russian, or you must be, you know, everyone's got a different take.
Well,
on
and
it.
You changed your name to a kind of vaguely foreign one, which helped that.
That was such a mistake, but it had a reason. I mean, to this day, I'll do a TV show or something to promote this movie, and they'll introduce me as William. It's Willem. It's a nickname. I was born William. I came from big family. My father was William. I didn't like Billy. And some friend of mine, theater friends, started calling me Willem.
Oh, so it was. So I see. That's interesting. So it was a sort of pseudo Dutch.
I didn't know
gesture.
I didn't know it was Dutch until I went to Holland for the first time.
Right.
Stupid me.
Yeah. Well, Willem, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Willem Dafoe is starring in The Hunter, 444 Last Day on Earth, and John Carter, all out this month. We talked for a lot longer, actually, and you can hear our entire conversation at studio360.org. Coming up, one man's junk is another man's treasure. That's what they say. Well, we're turning junk into treasure. Alchemy, Studio 360 style.
Oh, I love trash. Anything.
Coffee mugs are always a gold mine. I mean, you know, the world according to Dad.
Yeah.
For a buck.
So really, part of this process is buying stuff you would never actually buy in real life, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
If you really want to see something trashy, look at this.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
Love trash!
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. I recently wrote an entire short story about an old nutcracker with a Santa on it. Fiction about a real object. It was an assignment. A guy named Rob Walker got a whole bunch of writers, like Neil LaBute and Lydia Millett and Colson Whitehead, to write short stories about various dusty old objects that he'd acquired. A smiling jug, a plastic banana, my nutcracker. Then he auctioned off the trinkets, each with its new fictional origin story, on eBay. The proceeds were split between the writers and two charities. Now those stories are collected in a new book called Significant Objects, edited by Walker and Joshua Glenn.
Here we are.
I met up with Rob Walker the other day at a place called Vintage Thrift in New York.
Looks like there's some cheap stuff here.
Our goal was to find objects for a brand new set of stories to be written by you. So pay attention. So how did this idea come about?
Well, the secret brief history of it is that it came from me breaking a coffee cup that was a totally meaningless thing to 99.999% of people in the world, but it happened to be a coffee cup that I had bought on a trip with my now wife, which sent me on this tangent about stories and objects and how really the stuff we care about is the stuff that we attach stories to. And then the crucial leap was, could you just invent those stories?
So you went out and bought a bunch of objects at thrift stores?
And I live in Savannah, so I went to Goodwill, there's a Salvation Army, there's a Humane Society thrift store, and we set ourselves a spending limit of $4 tops per object. It ended up being, I believe, we did the math later, and for the first 100 objects, the average price was $1.28.
And how many did you buy?
Well, there was 100 for the first round, and then that went so well, we ended up doing about 220 stories all together.
Really?
Yeah. The selling price ended up being roughly $36 as an average. So $1.28 to $36. So we proved that with a great story, fascinating story, mathematically you could demonstrate the value changes, and we proved it on eBay.
Is this a scalable business? Could you do a million objects and make it?
We definitely had many inquiries because one of the ways we enticed writers was to tell them we'd give them the money, which we did. And there were some people saying, oh, you've invented a new publishing model where writers can actually make money for short stories.
Well, and as long as we're in this perfect thrift shop, let's look around and find some objects.
Find some stuff to buy.
Yes.
Rob and I burrowed through stacks of dishware, old records, books, coffee mugs.
Coffee mugs are always a gold mine. I mean, you know, the world according to Dad, for a buck. I would put this on my list right
now. Would you?
And then we hit the motherlode.
When you are in these places, there's always shelves that are sort of tucked away in the corner that are sort of where the loser objects go, and you always want to make sure that you spend a good amount of time checking them out.
This is like a wax pumpkin, a gourd. Yeah.
Figurines are often good. This is kind of frightening.
Yeah, it's a little sort of like a Tim Burton product, but clearly not. It existed before that with a strange, simple little head. It's kind of cool.
And it's sort of old enough that one of the eyes is sort of deteriorated, and it's like hovering, in my opinion, right on the verge of being garbage, but it's $5, so...
Yeah. So really, part of this process is buying stuff you would never actually buy in real life, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
What else have we got?
I'm grokking the process here.
You want to pick something? What's your eye drawn to?
I kind of like the Marlboro branded thermos.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, see, you've got a good eye. It's co-branded with Coleman. They would never do that.
That's what I'm thinking. It really, without being specifically dated, it could be any time from 1955 to now, but you know because it's branded Marlboro that it's from a while ago. Yeah.
$5. This I would put on the short list, too. Let's put this aside.
Yeah.
And see, this is another type of object that I'm attracted to. It's a block of wood, rounded at each end, with screws, and it...
It's obviously kind of homemade-ish.
And it has no...
Obvious function.
Obvious function or decorative property whatsoever.
It must have cut something... Or, yeah. I love it.
We have to get this.
Yeah, I agree. So we've got our three objects.
It's a go.
And now it's up to you. The thermos with the Marlboro logo, the slightly creepy little doll, and the wooden thingy. Pick one and write a backstory for it. You could write a conventional short story, a poem, a fake encyclopedia entry, a letter, whatever. Keep it brief, around 500 words. The deadline is April 9th. Rob Walker will come back to judge the entries, and each winner will get their corresponding tchotchke. Go to studio360.org for all the details.
All set? Great.
Special thanks to Vintage Thrift on 3rd Avenue in Manhattan for letting us come by.
$11.98.
$12.
Not bad.
Exactly your thing. $4.
Yeah. So we came in right in line with the budget. Objects waiting to be made significantly.
To close the show today, we will hear from an artist about the work of art that changed her life. Young Jean Lee creates provocative, fringy theater pieces. Her play, The Shipment, for instance, is a study of black identity, even though she herself is Korean-American. And most recently, she directed a piece called Untitled Feminist Show, performed by a half dozen women entirely in the nude. But before Young Jean Lee became an it girl of experimental theater, she was just another teenager awkwardly muddling through high school. In the late 1980s, she was one of the only Asian kids in Pullman, Washington.
I was incredibly sort of isolated there. Like, I didn't have any friends. And I remember the way that I dealt with being so foreign was to just try to assimilate as much as possible. You know, I remember I just wore whatever you're supposed to wear. You know, I wore like Esprit. And I listened to whatever was on the radio. So I remember I was listening to, like, Debbie Gibson and Tiffany and New Kids on the Block. The word weird was derogatory. Like, if I said, like, oh my God, that sounds really weird. Like, anything weird was bad. And anything normal was good. I remember at the time, you know, like I would buy everything with my allowance and I really loved magazines. But if I was going to buy a magazine, they were kind of actually expensive. So I ended up reading this entire Rolling Stone magazine from cover to cover. And one of the things in it was a review of the Beastie Boys' second album, Paul's Boutique. And the description of what it was that they were doing just sounded so alien, like a nightmarish cartoon of shell-cracking hooliganism that starts with the slinky bass line from Superfly, features echoey shrieks on the choruses, and closes with a slice of the theme from Psycho, which jarringly snaps off like a TV set. It was like the first time in my life that I'd ever heard of something that sounded weird that was intriguing. And then I went out and bought the album.
Hey, lady!
The thing that always stood out to me about Hey Ladies was the cowbells.
The ladies.
That always just made me die. And that's something they do so well, where it's the, like, there's this perfect thing that gets thrown in there, and you don't know why it's perfect or why it's there, you know? And the whole album is sort of like that. In most mainstream pop culture, things are sort of clear, like, you know, verse, chorus, verse. But with this album, it's not clear. It's confusing and it's messy. It's meticulously constructed, but the lyrics are all over the place. And things are put together because of how they sound and feel. I feel like the album really opened my mind to unconventional structures and the idea of playing with form and the idea of things just being right together without necessarily having a clear logic behind them. I listened to it pretty much nonstop. I mean, I had the entire album memorized, and I think it basically kind of rewired my brain. Now I'm the artistic director of Young Jean Lee's theater company, which produces plays that I write and direct. None of my plays have a linear plot, you know, like a storyline that goes from the beginning to the end. Like, they're all put together like a collage. I did a show called Songs of the Dragons Flying to Heaven, and I remember I just decided that there had to be this number where women wearing traditional Korean dresses scuttled around the stage and then mimed suicides to Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You. And I just remember it just popped into my head, and I was like, ah, this is the perfect thing to happen in this moment. And I feel like that's sort of my version of, like, the cowbell in Hey Ladies. You know, it was just something that felt right.
The playwright Young Jean Lee. Studio 360's Alana Harper produced our story. If there's some album or movie or book or play or any work of art that changed your life, tell us about it at studio360.org, and we might include your story on the show. And in case you need to hear a little more Beastie Boys, we've got the Hey Ladies video there at our website as well. And that's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen next time. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Rebecca Lee Douglas,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon, and our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, a young trumpeter from L.A. goes to a bullfight in Tijuana, Mexico.
And there was this brass band in the stand that would announce all the events. Ba-da, ba-da-da, ba-da-da, ba-da, bang, ole. There was something about that feeling that I thought maybe I could translate it into a sound.
Herb Alpert on the birth of the Tijuana Brass. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.